This is the SF Productions Podcast Network. How I Got My Wife to Read Comics, Episode 209. Can a comic collector of over 25 years get his wife to read them? Will she let him keep them? Learn more in this podcast. Let's go to the comic book lounge with Mindy and Mark.
Ice to meet you, Mr. Freeze. Buddy does times past. Giles' relatives drop by. And it's fish fingers, custard, and Earl Grey hot. This is How I Got My Wife to Read Comics for Sunday, June 3rd, 2012. I'm Mark.
And I'm Mindy. Just a reminder, you can go to sfpodcastnetwork.com to get the feed, other SF podcasts, and blogs. And you can subscribe via iTunes, where you can leave us a review.
And you can email sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com, like us at facebook.com/sfppn, follow us on Twitter @sfppn, or call us at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP. Well, there was only one regular DC title this week. This was the fifth week of the month, and so it's always kind of strange what comes out that week. The Ravagers, number one. We are jumping into this kind of in the middle because we didn't pick up all the Culling crossovers.
No, but we did, or at least I did, read the Teen Titans.
Oh, yeah, I read them, but you were kind of, you didn't get the whole thing, so it's...
Yeah, but I kind of think I picked up the gist.
Yeah, you got the gist. This issue, at least to me, seemed to be all action and little story.
Yeah, I didn't really think this was a good introductory issue.
No. We'll see how that goes. But there were a few other titles this week we wanted to talk about, starting with Batman Annual 2012, number one by Snyder, Tynion IV, and Fabok.
I have a question.
Yes.
If they hadn't have reset everything, would the annual then have a different number?
No.
Do annuals?
The annuals generally are number ones.
Okay.
They're officially annual and the year number one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious.
Well, actually, it depends. For a while there, they were actually the increase the number. But they haven't done that for a while, mainly because they do annuals so rarely anymore.
They used to do them a lot.
Yeah. Used to be regular every year.
They used to have big crossover events that tied through the annual.
Yep.
But now they do those through the regular titles instead.
Exactly.
Okay. Back to Batman.
So Mr. Freeze is introduced into the new 52. We learn that as a child, his mother fell through the ice, affected him emotionally. Did work for Wayne Industries.
Yeah.
And he was told, you need to drop these particular lines of cryogenic research you're doing. But he refuses to stop. And this experiment explodes on him and somehow transforms him. All because he wants to save his wife, Nora. But in this particular continuity, that's a delusion of his. Nora, the woman in the cryogenic chamber, was born in 1943 and frozen by her husband in the 1960s when she got cancer as one of the first people to get cryogenically frozen. Freeze wrote his doctoral thesis about her, and he's never actually met her in person, but he believes that Nora is his wife.
He's kind of whack.
Right. So Nightwing and Robin try to stop him, and that really doesn't work. And Freeze wants to use the formula from the owls, the one that are creating the talons, to save her. So we're tying it into the Night of the Owls thing. And Batman ends up using that same formula to stop him.
So my question is, why didn't Bruce Wayne at least take it seriously that this formula could unfreeze these people? I mean, they're frozen. You might as well try to unfreeze them.
You would assume, but generally in comics, if a supervillain has a formula, the good guys go, well, it can't possibly work because a supervillain came up with it. And it turns out that his mother's death is a delusion as well, that she did fall through the ice, but was apparently saved. And later, she's wheelchair ridden, and he ends up pushing her wheelchair back into the icy water. He kills her.
I was thinking that maybe the first accident that he was telling the psychiatrist about was what he wanted to believe.
Well, I was thinking that, and then I'm like, well, then why would she already be in a wheelchair? And they infer that something happened.
Right. So I'm not sure either. It
right.
could go either way
yeah.
on that
or
one.
Or some other accident had occurred or some injury occurred that she was now wheelchair ridden.
Right.
It's not very clear. But I have to say, I like this annual more than the next one. Annual Man Annual 2012, number one, by Lemire and Green 2, or Green the Second. I love how the artists start coming up with their own fake names.
Are they?
Oh, a lot of them. I believe they are. I mean, Tinian the Fourth. This storyline is certainly far less important to the overall storyline than the Batman Annual was, because the cover promises a crossover with Swamp Thing. But
well,
it's not really a crossover.
And you're saying you like the other one better. And I think I like this one better just because it's not going to be essential to the main timeline.
Well, generally, you don't want to make something so essential that you're forced to read the annual. But this just seemed like, okay, we're going to trade on the success of the Animal Man title to just slap out an annual.
Well, I really don't think that a year ago Animal Man would have been a title that got an annual.
Oh, of course not. So it ends up being this time past story from the cat familiar. Maxine goes off with the cat because the cat needs to do her business. She's like, tell me a story. And we hear this story about an 1894 fight in Canada between the Rot, the Red, and the Green. The Mounties that are involved are taken over by the Rot, and this young man with a son is taken by the Red, and this Indian trader becomes Swamp Thing. So, as I said, it really doesn't tie into the current story. It's very much a time past story, a la Starman. Whether we'll ever hear about this anymore, anything will ever tie into it, we have no idea. I have to say, I'd like to see the real crossover that they've been inferring since, I think, issue one of both titles would actually happen one of these days. Too much of this, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Oh, it's going to happen. When? Let's go.
I kind of feel like it better be really good now.
Right, because you've built it up so much.
There's so much build up to it.
Yes.
And as I've said before, I kind of wonder what's going to happen after that, if the title is going to be able to sustain its popularity.
Right, because everything has been leading up to that, and then what? Angel in Faith, number 10, from Dark Horse by Gage and Samney. So these two mysterious women arrive at Faith's home, who is, of course, Giles' old home, and we learn they're Giles' aunts, who they're keeping themselves young with magic and with various artifacts. And they're both very vain and self-centered. So they made a lot of deals in order to stay young, to get these artifacts. And the traders that gave them these deals, it's time to pay up. And fortunately, the pay up is their souls now that they have their first gray hair, is the idea.
I thought that was a pretty cute thing.
So there's this big fight with Angel and Faith, and these various demons and entities keep coming in. The ants don't help at all. They're like, well, we don't fight.
Well, and they can't really do much because they were all magic-based powers.
Right. At one point, one demon arrives and says, well, all you promised me was a kiss when this happened. And so there's a great shot of this other demon and Angel just like, well, okay, let's stop fighting for a second. I just want to see this.
Yeah.
And they're like, I agree. We get this flashback to Giles' childhood. We learn that he was forced to be a watcher at a very young age. Did we know anything about
yes.
this? Okay.
Well, just that he had kind of been forced into that watcher mold.
But no details prior to this.
Not really. And they always talked about having a Ripper series, you know, to mm-hmm. explain Giles' childhood. And that, I think, would have been really interesting. Hmm. Maybe they will yet come out with a comic book.
That'd be cool. So he never really got to be a kid. He never really had a regular childhood. And the ants give Angel this shard that apparently has Giles' child essence in it. So the ants want Angel to succeed in resurrecting him, but they expect Faith to step in if it happens to go badly. And at the end of the issue, Willow arrives.
And I think this is prepping for that Willow miniseries, right?
I would assume. Star Trek The Next Generation, Doctor Who, Assimilation Number 1 from IDW by Tipton, Lee, and Woodward. So we have another crossover from IDW. They've been pressing this and publicizing it for quite a while. The story begins on Delta 4, which is Ilea's planet from Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh.
I only figured that out because they're all bald.
All bald, yeah. Okay.
So there's this Borg invasion on the planet, but the Borg just attacks. They didn't ask for surrender first, which is what they always have done in the past. And some of the Borg are different. They're actually Cybermen. So how did all this happen? We don't know yet.
I thought that was a pretty good melding of two.
Right. So this armada of small ships manages to escape the planet. Then we switch over to ancient Egypt, where the 11th Doctor and the Pons are in the middle of a chariot race. They're trying to find the Pharaoh, and after a few adventures, they manage to find him. One of his advisors is actually an alien, and so that's why the Doctor's there, and he traps the alien in this crystal. So they're all back off in the TARDIS, and there's this rough landing, and they're in San Francisco 1941. But maybe they're not actually in San Francisco because they go into a bar and they find Data and Riker and maybe Crusher, because you only see a woman from the back, but I think it's the outfit she was wearing.
I thought it was too.
In period costume, of course. Is he in San Francisco or is he actually just in a Dixon Hill holodeck and somehow managed to get into there?
And I immediately thought they were in the holodeck.
Yeah, I assume it must be a holodeck. I really enjoyed the art for this. This kind of painted look.
Yes.
I enjoyed that a lot. The storyline seems intriguing. Certainly better than what we saw in the Legion Star Trek crossover, which wasn't, I think, all that very good. But this one, I think, sounds a lot better. And, of course, it's two properties that both IDW has the rights to right now.
So do you think that people who like just Star Trek will pick this up?
Yeah.
And people who like just Doctor Who will pick this up?
Yes. Yeah, I would assume you're going to get both audiences involved.
I didn't know if it was just that very small like intersection of people who like both Star Trek and Doctor Who would read it.
I wouldn't say it's that probably small an intersection, but I would say what groups that like either of them would probably pick this up. And if it does well, I would not at all be surprised to see them do other ones, because you could do other Doctors with other Star Trek series.
Well, or the current Doctor.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it'd be very, you got a lot of options there.
Yes, you do.
You know? You know, Tom Baker with DS9.
That was just what was in my head. I was going to say that.
Something like that. There is no Who's on the Cover this week. Damn you, Double Issues!
Yeah, Spider-Man.
Yep. We want to remind you to go to sfpodcastnetwork.com to get the feed, other SF podcasts and blogs, including my blog about Hogan's Heroes and Star Trek The Next Generation. You can subscribe via iTunes, and please leave us a review.
You can email sfpodcastnetwork@gmail.com, like us at facebook.com/sfppn, follow us on Twitter @sfppn, or call us at 614-321-9737. That's 614-321-9SFP.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.